Can we talk something else? Can we talk about something else?
Hello. Out there. Brian James Dugan was born prematurely on September 23rd of 1956, though not in the traditional sense. A nurse of the New Hampshire hospital that baby Dugan was attempting to come squalling into didn't want to deal with it. The doctor was late, and because the attending nurse wasn't comfortable doing the delivery herself, she shoved Dugan's head back into the womb, then strapped his mother's legs together. Some would later say that the nurse had the right idea. Put it back. Of course, it was the wrong idea. In fact, those first moments Brian Dugan spent trying to enter the world, using his baby brain as a battering ram, probably had a lot to do with what happened later. Welcome to Dark Topic. I'm your host, Jack Luna. This is a true crime happening. Dugan. Brian Dugan, the second of five children, would be remembered as a major problem throughout his childhood. As a toddler, he'd bang his head off of his crib constantly, this being the way he'd learned to get out of an uncomfortable situation. He was a bedwetter, a condition apparently shared by his father, a violent alcoholic. Dugan's mother drank too much as well, and was a strict disciplinarian. No doubt about it, Dugan took more than a few shots to the head growing up, maybe 1,000 or more. Dad was on the road as a traveling salesman most of the time, leaving mom to care for five kids. The bedwetting pissed her off big time. Dugan was forced to lay in his soaked, then eventually crusty sheets as punishment. The McDonald Triad, a controversial theory for predicting future serial killers, but more accurately suggests trauma in a person's childhood, is at work here. We have bedwetting, that's where it starts, especially if your parents shame you for it. The angry boy soon developed a fascination with fire. He was made to hold matches until he burned his fingers when caught playing with them. Mom liked to mix things up, including Brian's head, it seemed, and forced the boy to eat spoonfuls of hot sauce on the occasions where he was found playing with matches. Fingers and mouth on fire, he'd head off to bed to hit his head before passing out in piss. All of the punishments and humiliation didn't dissuade Dugan from misbehaving. He and a younger brother set fire to the family garage. This when Dugan was 8. Mom and dad did their best to beat some sense into their boy, but it seemed impossible to get through to him. It's almost as if he had brain damage or something. What are you, retarded? His dad would ask. This poor younger version of Brian James Dugan would probably say, yeah, I think I actually am kind of retarded, Pa. Maybe stop kicking me in the head. I'm not the TV set over here. And they're not from fucking wherever my accent's always from there, New Jersey or wherever the fuck I think it's from. They're from Illinois. The family relocated to Lisle, Illinois, in 1967 when Dugan was 10 years old, this in DuPage County. He continued misbehaving and found himself in all kinds of strange situations along the way. His parents wanted him out of the house and out of their hair. Speaking of hair, at age 13, he complimented that of his friend's mother. This led him to lose his virginity to the woman. Also at age 13, he poured gasoline on the family cat and set it ablaze. Dugan was seen laughing as the cat ran around screeching, eventually dying. As a result, young Brian Dugan, clearly fucked up, was evaluated by child specialists, but his kind of issues were not fully understood or sufficiently treated at the time. Siblings of Brian Dugan, whom we get most of this information from later, reported possible sexual abuse during a stay in a youth detention facility around 1972. After being arrested for trespassing and burglary, Dugan was... Dugan later spoke about his experiences being molested as an early teen. These revelations came to light while he was incarcerated as an adult, though some of it is hard to believe, considering one instance where Dugan claimed to have been coming out of a Lisle grocery store when he was offered a job by a portly man in a car who then drove him to a secluded spot, requested Dugan dress in men's model briefs, then allow fellatio to be performed on him by the man.
That's the job? Well, all right.
And after being paid $20, Dugan, 15 years old, went on his way. I think he had to give the briefs back. Now, I said it was hard to believe. None of that should be too hard to believe, considering what's been going on so far, until you learn that Dugan claimed the man who molested him was a mostly friendly fella named John Wayne Gacy. And maybe it's true. We are in that time and that place. Brian Dugan did fit Gacy's victim profile. If so, an awful yet unlucky kid in Dugan finally catches a break by surviving the encounter with Gacy. And he made $20. Pretty sweet. I'm being facetious, of course, I should say. But a guy like Dugan in a time like the 70s saw it as a score. Said he did. Getting blown by a legend like John Wayne Gacy when you're destined to become a serial killer yourself. And I hate to use all my big words at once, but how serendipitous. Also, since we're loosening up here a bit, I didn't want to say it earlier because people get upset these days about such things, and for good reason, but it goes without saying how Dugan felt about being sexually molested by his friend's mother. The kid was just getting lucky all over the place. Though, of course, and I must be clear, I think it was bad what was happening to the kid, even though he said it felt pretty good. Dugan's documented criminal activity began soon after his alleged interaction with Gacy. Again, we only have Brian Dugan's word on that, and it came soon after Gacy was arrested in 78, which many say is convenient. I say it's just the first time Dugan saw Gacy in the paper. If Eileen Warnos had been the mother he banged, Dugan would be saying her name too. I mean, after researching the proximity to Gacy, Lisle, Illinois, where Dugan claims to have been abducted, and Norwood Park, the Chicago suburb where Gacy brought boys to bury them, are less than half an hour's drive apart. To say it's a stretch is a stretch in and of itself, in my opinion, that he was molested by Gacy. Dugan, after having been arrested and definitely enduring sexual assaults in juvie, came home and molested his younger brother Steve, telling the boy he'd be just a piece of meat in prison, and this wasn't close to as bad at what it was like for Dugan. And that's nice. Big brother teaching little bro a lesson. Always nice to get a little breather in these kind of episodes. Get that tender moment. Dugan at 17 broke into a KFC with a buddy at night and robbed a safe of $4,000. And I can't seem to help myself. I'm trying to stay out of these, but here I am. Gacy ate a bucket of KFC as his last meal. Gacy was also manager of 3 KFCs in Iowa back in the 60s. No connection to the robbery here by Dugan in the 70s, none whatsoever. It's just interesting to me that after this KFC robbery, Dugan ran away to Iowa, where Gacy was manager of KFCs back in Iowa in the 60s. Don't let me lose you here, but to me, that stuff is just plain spooky. Completely unrelated to anything of substance, but imagine teenage Dugan is molested in the early 70s by John Wayne Gacy. Then, Dugan is so thrown off by the Gacy encounter that he begins a life of crime now involving a sexual element. He's like a Gacy offshoot, bound in a twisted way to Gacy, psychically somehow, maybe by shooting his load in Gacy's mouth. So there's coincidences here, like the KFC robbery and then the subsequent runaway to Iowa. They begin peppering into Dugan's life story after this event, he claims, what happened with Gacy. And these are seemingly inconsequential elements that make up Gacy's own story as well, the KFCs and Iowa. To me, they're markers, ingredients. The secret recipe of all that we don't understand. Anyways, Dugan ran away to Iowa that year of 73 with an accomplice in the KFC heist, but was eventually caught committing more thefts and brought home to pay the piper or the colonel. After his release in the summer of 74, now 18-year-old Dugan attempted to abduct a 10-year-old from the Lisle train station. Fortunately for the girl, it was broad daylight and her screams drew enough attention to spook Brian Dugan off. The girl ran to a nearby liquor store run by her father, and police were called. Dugan, who was well known in the community, soon was arrested, but eventually released either on a technicality or as a result of the charges being dropped. It's not clear which. Either way, a big mistake was made here. Dugan had proven himself by this point to be a menace and had no business being loose in society. Not long after the attempted kidnapping, Dugan found himself in jail anyways, after having kicked in the headlights of his sister's car and threatening to chop up his 2-year-old nephew. The single mother had been nice enough to take Dugan in, and this is how he repaid her after being told he couldn't use her car to transport some stolen goods. In March of 76, the 20-year-old version of Dugan seemed to finally fuck up bad enough to be put away for years after setting an elementary school on fire for the hell of it. He was sentenced to 3 years in prison, but was paroled after 7 months served. He avoided another lengthy prison sentence in 1979 after attempting to abduct a store clerk. She got away, and Dugan got away with it, as there wasn't enough evidence to charge the chronic offender. Naturally, another opportunity came that same year of 79, when now 23-year-old Dugan was arrested for burglary at his new apartment. Dugan had a girl living with him, a 14-year-old runaway, who admitted she and Dugan were in a sexual relationship. Brian Dugan is sentenced to 7 years for contributing to the sexual delinquency of a minor and burglary. Dugan served 3 years at Menard Correctional Center before once again being gifted an early release. Dugan, now 26 years old, was seen as immature and not much of a threat. He was abused all through his prison stints. A mousy, long-haired, mustached, gangly white boy, greasy-looking with a lost look. Dugan fooled everyone into thinking him a victim, just a screwed-up young man with a tough past, clearly mentally disabled in some way, poor impulse control, but useless when it came to serious crimes. He'd attempted at least 2 kidnappings, but they'd been so lame that charges hadn't been able to stick. Dugan was a loser. And yeah, he'd probably be back, probably for stealing a washing machine or something. He was always getting caught dragging crap away that was too heavy for him. An imbecile. A sensation-addicted neurotic is what prison psychologists dubbed him. He drank, smoked a lot of weed. Back then it was thought this could be enough for dopes like Dugan to do stupid shit. Maybe he'd grow out of it. Less than a year after his latest prison stint, in late February of 1983, Dugan did the opposite. He grew into it. Big surprise. Wednesday, February 23rd, 1983. Naperville, Illinois. 26-year-old Brian Dugan has blown off work again to cruise around and smoke weed. He gained employment as an ink mixer for an art and label shop, which had taken a gamble on the repeat offender and lost. He's fucking it up, but that's not Dugan's main concern right now. As of this morning, he has nowhere to live. His girlfriend had broken up with him because he owed her and her father money, and now, out of nowhere, her father had informed Dugan that he was no longer welcome to stay in his basement. What a crock of shit. He'd be paying his fair share, as much as he could on his meager salary made measly by all the skipped days like today. His feelings were hurt by the whole thing. Dugan, of course, couldn't get it through his thick, albeit compressed at the front and dented all around skull, that he wasn't welcome anymore because of the breakup. You can't stay in your girlfriend's dad's basement where his daughter still lives as well if the daughter broke up with you. Dugan. Whatever, it's still fucking bullshit. His car, a green Plymouth Volare with a missing hubcap on the back, allegedly breaks down at this point while he's cruising around little neighborhoods out there in small town Illinois, as if things couldn't get any worse. It's 2:30 p.m. and Dugan realizes that this is a prime time for breaking into houses. He looks around stone to check out where he's ended up. It's a quaint little suburb with street signs that read Book Road and Clover Court. Dugan gets out of his old junker, claiming later he approached the nearest home only with the intent of borrowing a screwdriver. Why he creeps across the grass like a serpent before reaching the sunroom of the split-level house laid back there, minding its own business, we understand soon enough. Dugan, as always, is up to no good. Inside, 10-year-old Janine Nicarico responds to the sound of the front storm door screeching open.
Mom?
Janine, wearing only a snow-white nightgown with the words, "I'm sleepy," on it, is homesick from school with the flu. Her dad, an engineer, is at work in Chicago. Her mom, a secretary at Janine's school down the street, is keeping close tabs on the fifth grader who she signed at herself, firsthand. Mom had just gotten off the phone with her daughter, reminding her not to open the front door should anyone knock. Dugan's gaunt, ratty mustache face, long hair dangling in front of it like a fucking curtain, seems to hang in the window of that door when Janine alerts to it.
Hi, can I borrow a screwdriver?
The girl shakes her head. Dugan, unfortunately, then has an idea, blood rushing to the wrong head as it comes to him.
Okay, are your parents home?
The girl shakes her head again. Her parents are not home. Big mistake. Dugan, without another word nor thought, steps back and begins kicking in the door. Janine runs upstairs to her bedroom and hides, stifling sneezes and coughs, no doubt, as she's quite ill. It doesn't take long before the front door crashes open. 2 big boots is all it needed. Then heavy footfalls begin making their way through the house, up the stairs, slamming through Janine's door. The 10-year-old is dragged kicking and screaming out of her room. Dugan beats on the little girl and manages to knock her senseless enough to get her bed blankets wrapped around her, then carries her downstairs. He finds some rope, ties her up, and gags her. Then Dugan goes out to his car, pulls it in the driveway. Miraculously, it runs fine now, though probably it always had. We are working off of Dugan's recollection of events, the only version, as he then drives Janine 5 miles away to a nature preserve where he rapes the little girl in every way possible. Then he drags her from the vehicle and beats her to death with a tire iron, slamming her head first into his car for good measure. He then dumps the naked body of Janine in the bush by a river and a hiking path, and later tosses her blankets in a dumpster of a grocery store. Incredibly, Dugan returns to his ex-girlfriend's father's basement, where he hides the tire iron. After having some time to think, then being kicked out again, Dugan gets rid of his boots in a farm field, believing his prince could track him down somewhere along the line. A line that he should have been hung from in the end. The little girl is quickly called into police as missing when her sisters come home to find the front door smashed open. Their mother received the sickening call first. She'd just spoken to Janine. How? The family dog, which likely met Dugan's boot, is shivering, scared in the laundry room. Investigators soon arrive and eventually discover blankets missing from Janine's bedroom and scratch marks on the walls throughout the home from the girl's attempts to resist being dragged away. 2 days later, hikers find Janine Nicarico's little body. Her face is difficult to recognize, but the nightdress is not. I'm sleepy. DNA, though in its infancy, is present with semen and collected. A boot print is lifted from the door, and a lead about a green Ford Granada leaving the dump site is pursued, but becomes a red herring as Dugan drove a Volare, and the investigation would prove to be run by mostly slackers and corrupt officials. The public demands an arrest, and they get 3, when a $10,000 reward baits a few patsies in to take the fall. 19-year-old gangbanger Crazy Alex Hernandez comes forward, claiming to know who did it. Alex isn't very bright. He thinks he can just throw a couple names out there, one being a phantom, quote, white boy named Rick, and he'll make a quick 10 grand if they buy this shit. Investigators can't possibly believe this kid, but because of the pressure on them and their bosses, including DuPage County State's Attorney Michael Fitzsimmons, who was up for election, an arrest was announced. A year into the investigation and only weeks away from election time, 3 young men with histories of misbehavior, Alex Hernandez, Rolando Cruz, and Stephen Buckley, were announced as being the culprits. It was said that Cruz had confessed after being ratted out by Crazy Alex, then Cruz had given details only known to police and the perpetrators. In reality, Crazy Alex had been pressed to give up a real name, not just white boy Rick, in order to get the reward money. Under pressure, he gave the name of Rolando Cruz, who was also a gangbanger, but of course innocent. Investigators manipulated Cruz into a confession by feeding him details of the crime. This led to Cruz saying Crazy Alex was actually responsible, and now Stephen Buckley, an associate of Cruz, was dragged into the mix, and a boot print impression from Buckley matched to the one lifted from the Nicarico front door was said to have matched. Anyways, both Cruz and Crazy Alex are sentenced to death for the crime. Stephen Buckley avoids death but is still suspected as being involved. It's found his footprint doesn't in fact match the one on the door. It's the same type of footwear, but the wrong size. Just another clue that something was hinky here, but the wheels of injustice went grinding on, chewing up 3 innocent lives in the process. I'm sure you can imagine how these guys were treated in prison, their alleged crime being the kidnapping, gang rape, torture, and murder of a 10-year-old girl, home alone and sick, wearing a Snow White and the Seven Dwarves nightgown. They were fucked. Literally. State's Attorney Fitzsimmons loses the election despite his best efforts to steal it, though he and investigators are congratulated for at least getting 2 of the 3 who allegedly meant to burglarize the Nicarico home but decided to destroy a little girl instead when the opportunity presented itself, sentenced to death. Rolando Cruz and Alejandro Hernandez will sweat on death row for 12 years. Meanwhile, Brian Dugan laid relatively low. He was arrested for burglary again and accused of trying to snatch a few more girls unsuccessfully. but no suspicion turned to him, as the Jeanine Nicarico case had already been solved by questionable authorities. I want to mention one detective named John Sam, who was released from the department after voicing his suspicions that the wrong men had been convicted. He tried. It would take nearly a decade and a half for the truth to come out, but by then many lives had been deeply affected by this crime and the blatant mishandling of it. In the end, all officials involved in the botched investigation, the DuPage County 7, I believe they were called, were cleared of any wrongdoing. A joke. Though nothing was funny here, with a homicidal pedophile on the loose in Brian Dugan, bolstered by the buffoonery and the botched Book Road break-in, it's just brutal. And sorry I get stuck on alliteration when I become bothered. Let's take a break. Back in a bit. A brief break. All right, mood everybody. Let me tell you about the online cannabis company that's revolutionizing how we deal with life's challenges. From sleepless nights to stress-filled days, Mood.com has created an entire line of functional gummies and functional flower crafted for your ideal mood, made with 100% federally legal THC. Not only that, but they'll deliver them discreetly right to your doorstep. And you can get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code DARKTOPIC. I've tried a bunch of their stuff myself, and it's wild how different each one feels. Their Sleepy Time gummies knock me out in about 15 minutes flat. No hangovers, no grogginess. I wake up feeling amazing. And their Epic Euphoria gummies, they're perfect for those days when nothing's going right, and you just need to hit the reset button on your crappy mood. What makes these different is how they've paired THC and other cannabinoids with herbs and adaptogens. You're just not going to find gummies like this in a dispensary, or anywhere for that matter. But their flower is what really blows me away. I'm like a flower in the wind. They partner with small family-owned U.S. farms who are custom cultivating their bud with unique terpene profiles. So you can choose a strain to help you feel more social, aroused, chilled out, even focused and productive. I'm into all that, and not necessarily in that order. I mean, they have cannabis products for literally everything. Immune support, menopause relief, PMS symptoms, mental clarity, sexual arousal, and each one is crafted using federally legal cannabis grown on these small family-owned farms. No pesticides, no BS, and they can ship directly to your door. Best of all, not only does Mood stand behind everything with an industry-leading 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, you listening can get 20% off your first order with code DARKTOPIC. So head to Mood.com, browse their amazing selection of functional gummies, and find the perfect gummy for whatever you're dealing with. And remember to use promo code DARKTOPIC at checkout to save 20% on your first order. Mood, everybody. The wee hours of July 15th, 1984. It's been nearly a year and a half since his first known murder, that of wee Jeanine Nicarico, and Dugan's feeling pretty confident that he's free to strike again. Donna Schnorr, a 27-year-old nurse, is sitting in her car at a desolate red light in Aurora, turn signal ticking away her final moments. A train maybe drives by in the distance. It's 3 a.m. when Dugan, driving around smoking weed, spots her. Donna is headed home after a party. It's late, and she likely just wants to get to bed. But when Dugan begins following her from her lonely stop at the intersection, then down a country road, Donna no doubt becomes alert as Dugan speeds up beside her before forcing her over to the ditch. Both vehicles screech to a halt, dust swirling in the headlamps, engines muttering to one another that Nurse Schnorr won't be doing so anytime soon. Dugan gets out of his vehicle. It's dark and desolate. No one will hear her scream, though the woman doesn't stand a chance, as when she rolls her window down to curse the slimeball stoner out, he punches her in the face. Stunned, Donna is reefed from her car and shoved into Dugan's green Plymouth, where he ties her hands behind her back. Dugan then drives Donna Schnorr to a nearby rock quarry and brutally rapes her in every imaginable way. Then he drags her to a pond. Her screams, echoing off the rocks, are cut short when Dugan forces Donna's head into the water. He holds it there until she drowns. Then, looking up at the sky, sees the light. Dawn. Time flies when you're having fun. As he's driving out of the quarry, a car passes him. Fishermen headed to that same water. Dugan, fearful his vehicle will eventually betray him, quickly heads home and makes plans that same day to trade his green Plymouth in for an old AMC Gremlin. Blue. Like the face of the poor woman, the fishermen eventually spot at the water's edge. Dugan lays low again until another opportunity strikes on May 6th, 1985. Dugan spots a young woman minding her own business, sitting in her car, parked. He's feeling like maybe something normal could happen. Dugan pulls up his coughing gremlin and gets out. He walks up and asks the pretty lady if she'd like to go for a date. When she politely declines, Dugan then offers her $80 for sex. This offer is also declined. Jesus, what's it gonna take? Dugan looks around, sees they're alone, then goes around to her passenger side, gets in, and presents a hunting knife. Do as I say and you won't get hurt. Dugan then escorts the girl to his car, where he ties her hands behind her back, blindfolds and gags her, lays her down, and drives off. Once to a secluded spot, he rapes his captive. Then he decides to take her blindfold off, untie her, and drive her back to her car. All the while chatting away, sharing his name, Brian, and behaving as though everything's cool. Though if she turned his way, Dugan would demand she not. Don't look at me, bitch! Anyways, what high school did you go to? When he dropped her off, Dugan first looked through her wallet, found photos of her family, and promised to kill them if she went to police. Then, he let her go. Driving away, he maybe lit a joint, switched on some tunes, rolled down the window to feel the breeze in his mustache. What a nice young lady. That was a good time. I should go on dates more often. 3 weeks later, on May 28th of 85, Dugan attempted to abduct a 19-year-old woman in Aurora. She escaped and noted his license plate. Authorities did not immediately act. The next day, Dugan abducted and raped a 16-year-old girl in Aurora, wrapping a belt around her neck and threatening to beat her to death with a tire iron if she didn't cooperate. She did. And this scene ends much like the other so-called date. Dugan tells her his full name and acts as though what happened was fine. He drops her off near her house and drives off blasting Meatloaf, probably. The girl reported the crime and recalled Dugan's first name and last initial. Police now had A, his license plate, B, his first name, and C, a description of him and his vehicle, but they'd track him down too late. For their effort, I, like the 16-year-old victim here, would give them a D. The last initial of the strange, sadistic serial dater, about to turn serial killer, Dugan. Less than a week later, on June 2nd, 1985, Dugan is smoking dope on the back roads of small-town Illinois again, in his now dented up and rusted blue gremlin. A highly recognizable vehicle should police have been looking for it. Instead, two little girls playing on their bikes, alone on this dirt road, spot it slowly coming around the bend, then stopping in front of them. Dugan gets out, asking for directions. The girls, 7-year-old Melissa Ackerman and 8-year-old Opal, try to help, getting off their bikes when the mousy man says he can't hear them. Once close enough, Dugan grabs Opal and throws her into the gremlin's passenger side before slamming the door. Then he goes chasing Melissa, who is running around the car, yelling for her friend Opal to get out. Opal can't immediately. Dugan has removed the passenger door handle just for this purpose. Outside, Melissa continues to avoid Dugan, running around the car, shouting instructions. Go out the window, Opal! Opal does, but then Melissa is caught, and as Opal exits, Melissa is shoved in to replace her. Opal takes off running into a field, then hides in a discarded truck tire in a John Deere lot. She hears the gremlin mutter, then putter away. Opal looks out from her hiding spot and catches a glimpse of her friend Melissa's face, screaming from the passenger side window, now sealed, like the brave girl's fate. Dugan managed to quiet the little girl by promising not to hurt her. He drove 20 miles west to a secluded campsite by a creek and told the 7-year-old to get out. There, they talked for a bit, probably because Melissa was trying to buy time and win him over. Dugan later shared that the little girl showed him how good she was at cartwheels, after having spoke about her love for gymnastics. Melissa Ackerman, wise well beyond her years, had saved her friend through distraction and now is attempting to do it for herself. But Dugan wouldn't bite. Or maybe he did. I'm sorry and disgusted to say that he then beat, raped, then drowned the poor kid in the creek. Her body was not recovered for several weeks. The surviving girl, Opal, later testified against Brian Dugan. Dugan was arrested on June 3, 1985, as a suspect in the Melissa Ackerman murder and unrelated sex attacks after Opal's description of the vehicle matched one pulled over for an expired sticker. On November 19, 1985, Dugan pled guilty to the murders of Nurse Schnorr and young Melissa Ackerman, plus related charges, in exchange for two life sentences plus 215 years, avoiding the death penalty. During questioning, he informally confessed to the Nicarico murder, providing details only the perpetrator would know, including specifics later corroborated by forensics. Prosecutors at that time dismissed portions as unreliable. In 1987, while incarcerated, Dugan was stabbed multiple times. Reports vary between 12 and 30 times in the arm and chest, but survived, which is a shame. His admission to the Janine Nicarico kidnapping and murder made a real mess. The system wanted Rolando Cruz and Crazy Alex Hernandez and Stephen Buckley to be responsible. And they fight this. It's a big struggle. Even with the confession from Dugan and his DNA in the Nicarico case, they don't want to admit they could have been wrong. DNA wasn't yet conclusive evidence, but it was on the scene, and they said that, yeah, it's some of that could have been belonging to Rolando Cruz from our testing here. Some of it definitely belongs to Brian Dugan. Keep these guys in prison until we figure this out. When Dugan says he kicked the front door in with two kicks, they think they have him lying. There's only one kick on the front door that they know of. He lied about Gacy, they say, so maybe he's lying here too. They pursue this, they look at the door again, which was removed from the Nicarico residence and kept as evidence, and find that yes, there are two footprints, superimposed on one another. He kicked in the same spot twice. Oh fuck, he did it. Shit. Let those poor buggers go and give them $3.5 million to split. And that's what happens. These guys get let go after being on death row for a dozen years and are paid off. Dugan confessed to the Nicarico murder as a way to stave off the death penalty, though it didn't matter, as it was eventually abolished in 2011 for Illinois. Still, there was a window of opportunity there. Remember, this wrapped up in the early 90s, where they could have gotten rid of him. Though, if the process were that speedy, two other innocent men in Cruz and Hernandez would have been executed too. So there's that to consider. Anyways, Dugan's still alive, 69, and feeling fine. What a piece of shit. And that'll do it. Thank you for listening. For exclusive content, try Dark Topic Plus. Links in the show notes. Got something nice to say, something not so nice, leave a review. Actually, let's read a few reviews for fun here at the end. All right, let's do two positives and a negative, like when you're giving somebody feedback. 5 stars. Oh, man. The Bukowski of podcasting. How embarrassing. Thanks, Jim's Hymns. That doesn't sound like a 5-star review. If I've ever acted like Bukowski or said I want to be like him, that is embarrassing, so I agree with you. I was probably drunk when I said that. Let's get an actual positive review. Let's go down a bit here. Immediately hooked. Can't get enough. Happy to pay extra for the treasure trove of back episodes and extra content. When Jack and Kent team up, the chemistry is fantastic. Somehow I'm crying with laughter during the most horrific of stories. Jack Luna on his solo episodes has such dry, razor-sharp... Okay, enough. Thank you very much. A really unique style. I know. Storytelling that's keen and leaves one absolutely enthralled. Oh, my God. Okay, enough. Another positive. Why not? Jack is real and refreshing. 5 stars. Love the show. Long-time listener. Can't believe it's been 6 years. Has it been 6 years? I started in 2017, February, so it's actually been 9 years. But it's been 6 years since I rebooted the show. So maybe that's where some confusion is there. But thank you very much. Amazing, amazing podcast. Thank you, Pink. Jack's the GOAT. Yeah. Jack Luna is one of my favorite hosts of all time, with his combination of wit, humility, respect, and knowledge of each topic, including Marooned. His ability to colorfully describe even the mundane keeps me listening. Okay, thank you so much. Milk Bube. And a negative. I think I already had a negative. but there's one here. Okay, waste of time and money, 1 star. I tried to give this guy a chance. He spends almost 10 minutes in the beginning of each episode rambling about nothing until he gets to the actual story. The first episode I listened to, he rambled about how he cheat on his girlfriends and then be hurt when they cheat on him. Who cares? This isn't what I paid to listen to. Also paying to listen to a podcast and hearing the host smoking weed. I don't smoke weed. I have cigarettes. And cracking open beers is just trashy. No thanks. Okay, well, that's fine. I was talking about what they're talking about there on one of the Dark Topic Plus episodes about a character I was writing about in a story and how I could relate, like he was getting cheated on and stuff, and I had all this insight, and then I started thinking about my past relationships, and I was like, oh shit, yeah, I've been cheated on in almost every relationship. But then I was like, wait, I cheated on almost every girl I was with, like when I was younger, right? And all the way up until, like all through my life. So I have a problem with this one because it's saying how he cheated on his girlfriend. My girl doesn't listen to this podcast, but if she did one day look at the reviews and I was like dead or something from being the Bukowski of true crime, she'd be like, what? He was talking about him cheating on me? No, that's disingenuous, that feedback there. And also you came over to my paid stuff, probably came for free and then heard something you didn't like and then left that review. You must have liked the podcast before that, right? But then you leave a 1-star review on the first thing you hear that you don't like. I'm reminded of a saying on all that, and it's familiarity breeds contempt, rarity wins admiration. That's an old saying that I never really understood until I started doing this podcast. I mean, I'm open. I make myself very familiar to the audience, especially on the Dark Topic Plus and Brutal and all that. I try to pull back a bit when it comes to publicly as Dark Topic got more and more popular and I got weird feedback and messages and it's true. I mean, familiarity breeds contempt. People think that they know me because they hear what they hear on the podcast. And then when they don't like me for some reason, if say I say something to them directly when they're being shitty to me, or I say something on the podcast that, you know, pisses them off, then they'll take that familiarity and use it against me. Also with familiarity breeding contempt, it's like, have you ever had improve yourself and then the people that you were around try to drag you back, like crabs in a bucket, they call it, try to pull you back down because they're more familiar with that version of you that was kind of shittier like them. And now you're trying to prove yourself and they're like, hey, well, you think you're better than me? And they try to pull you back down. So the familiarity with people that I've had here, it breeds some contempt. And rarity breeds admiration because it's like they don't really know you. You're fresh, you're new, and everything you do is fucking new and interesting and worth admiring. So, I mean, I put myself out there and this is what I get sometimes and it comes with the territory. But that being said, I want to say that I really, really appreciate all the positive fucking feedback that comes through, and all the little negatives are worth it for being as open as I am and for the relationship that I have with a lot of people in the audience and all that stuff. But going forward, I think I am going to try to pull back a bit and kind of hang out behind the scenes on Dark Topic Plus with the extras about my life and all that, because it has gotten a little weird, as you can imagine. So, anyways, I should listen to my own advice and keep those eyes cocked, those doors locked, and stay paranoid. Big love, everyone. I'll talk to you real soon. Life is brutal, but we do our best to make it beautiful. So, hang in there. We just keep on fucking trucking, I guess.